Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's Friday, so welcome to the Week in Review, beginning with the state budget and political fisticuffs over the so-called Pacheco Law on Beacon Hill. In one corner, Gregory Sullivan and the conservative-leaning Pioneer Institute.
Let's put the truth to this. This is the most extreme union protectionist legislation in the United States.
And in the other corner, State Senator Mark Pacheco.
What they're claiming is just unsubstantiated. They're an organization that has been opposed to the statute for many, many years and have done everything they can, including, quite frankly, not being very accurate with the truth.
Blackguard, says one. Scoundrel, says the other. And as with every pitched ideological battle, where does the truth really reside? Frank Phillips of the Boston Globe tells us.
I'll meet you down at the State Archives. We'll pull those 97 contracts out. And we'll spend, 3 months, dusting them off and comparing figures, and maybe we can come to some conclusion.
Okay, well, that's 3 months from now, but let's see if we can get closer to a better understanding today with our Week in Review panel. Joining us is Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, great to see you again.
Thank you.
And also with us today is Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Globe. Callum, welcome to you.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
Okay, so first, that $38 billion budget, lots to dig into, but let's focus on the Pacheco Law. I mean, it basically requires that if a state agency wants to hire a private company to deliver a service, it has to prove that it would save the state money. And now the current budget exempts the MBTA from the Pacheco Law for 3 years, something that Governor Baker has wanted. So, Renee and Callum, let me just throw this out to both of you. Is it fair to characterize the battle we heard between Mark Pacheco and Gregory Sullivan as not so much a practical one and rather an ideological one, Renee?
Yes, I think that I tend to agree with Senate President Rosenberg, who also said that the animus toward the Pacheco Law is really more driven by ideology than it is by the facts. But having said that, I have to say that I'm happy to have it suspended for these 3 years. I mean, I think the Carmen Union are not sympathetic in this play. They've fought, MBTA reforms. I mean, I can remember MBTA reforms in the 1980s that they fought bitterly, and they have, throughout. And I think that after the debacle of this winter with the MBTA, I think even the Carmen's Union themselves felt and recognized that they had a really hard case to make.
Callum?
Well, I think that whether you like it or not, one of the key provisions here is that it is a temporary suspension, right? So it's 3 years, and the default is to go back to enforcing the Pacheco Law when that time is up. And I think what that does, of course, is it forces the legislature to reevaluate at that point. So we'll get to kind of take a test drive. Frank's talking about 3 months, but, let's go 3 years, right? And at that point, you'll be able to kind of look back and have some sense of, did the greater freedom to privatize these services actually reduce costs as hoped, or did it really not make a big difference?
I know. So, I mean, this is one of those classic policy questions where, someone, if they wanted to, could go in and dig through the data about the contracts that have already been privatized versus those who haven't. But as Frank intimated, that would take a lot of effort, quite frankly. So maybe, as Callum, as you're saying, here's a test drive, a 3-year test run. We've got some tape from Charlie Baker, who talked this week about the Pacheco Law suspension. And he said it's really not about privatizing the T, in his words, or even laying off T employees. Here's the governor.
This was about using the opportunity to contract services out to enterprises and entities that are already out there that would be happy to engage with the Commonwealth where it can be done in a most effective way and probably in a way that works better for the traveling public, better for the taxpayer, and in the long run, I would argue, better for the T.
So that's Governor Baker, and his point of view has won the day in the budget. But I want to ask both of you, I mean, when we talked to Senator Pacheco, he pointed out that two things. One is that since the Pacheco Law had been passed, that he says, 80% of those privatizing contracts that have been put to the state regarding the T have actually been approved. So most of them get approved. And he says, so isn't that evidence in and of itself that the Pacheco Law is actually working? The good contracts get through, the bad ones don't.
Well, you know, what it says to me, and I think somebody needs to actually see these, you know, figures. But what it says to me is that if the Pacheco Law is intended only to allow privatization, if it can be proved that the privatized service would be cheaper and better than the public service, and 80% of them are being approved, then what does that say about the public service? That it's, you know, that there's 80% of the contracts that can be better delivered by the private sector. So, I mean, frankly, I don't think that Pacheco, the senator, does himself and his cause very much good, you know, with this figure that he keeps throwing around.
But maybe he's saying that it's a system, the checks are there in the right way, Callum.
That's one way to look at it, although, I mean, there's likely some selection bias there as well, right? So, you know, people, I think, on both sides agree that the Pacheco Law is sort of complicated. And so, you know, there may be something going on, right, where you, unless you're pretty darn sure that this privatization proposal you have is going to pass, you're not even going to bother presenting it, right? I mean, it's like if I told you I went to the golf course, Meghna, to practice my putting and I sank 80% of my putts, you might be less impressed if you found out that I only picked putts within 4 feet, right? Because I thought those were the ones that I could make. So, you know, that could be going on as well.
Okay, forgive me for saying this, but I'm not sure I see the problem with that. Am I just being deliberately obtuse here, Callum? I mean, if private companies are forced to present contracts that they know are going to be good for the state, what's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing inherently wrong with it, and it's a good point. And the other big question that I have, as I'm following when we heard from Baker, is, you know, how exactly is he and the T administrators going to use this new freedom that they have? I'm curious whether they were actually going to use it, you know, to go out and sign a whole bunch of new deals with private contractors that they think are going to save money. Or is it really more about the threat of going private, right? Like, in other words, is the primary purpose really just to put pressure on everybody at the T to improve the in-house operations and, you know, hold on to their work? Either way, then, of course, taxpayers would win.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, which I hadn't thought of before. And I would also say this, that on behalf of the Democratic legislature that allowed this to become part of the budget, it's politically smart for them to give Governor Baker the tools that he says he needs in order to fix the T, because now he has this, and he has the fiscal control board that he wanted, and now there are fewer excuses for him if he can't deliver a better quality T.
Yeah, that's an excellent point that I hadn't thought of either. So, so revelations every day here on Radio Boston. Let's dig into some of the other aspects of the budget, because it is a $38 billion state budget and it aimed to close a projected $1.8 billion shortfall. And so this budget includes a reduction in the state spending growth, an extension of the tax credit for low-income workers. And here we have a little bit of tape from House Speaker Robert DeLeo.
We're very pleased with those items, as well as attacking issues such as, well, most importantly, as substance abuse, and providing more funds for early education and other investments.
Governor Charlie Baker was also similarly pleased with how this budget shook out.
The legislature chose not to raise taxes and fees to close that budget gap, but instead pursued a series of reforms and belt tightening that we thought was a better way to go.
Callum and Renee, I mean, I don't know about you. I haven't had time to comb through the budget too much, but somehow I see that, you know, they tried to close an almost $2 billion shortfall, but I'm not hearing the typical outcry from groups that are suffering the effects of that budget, that gap closure or cuts. I mean, what are the significant cuts, if any, in the budget?
Well, one of the ones that really caught my eye was just cutting, and it was sort of obscure, but it was cutting a corporate tax break, which was used to pay for that expansion of the earned income tax credit, which tied into what became sort of this somewhat glamorous debate over the film tax credit, right? Because Baker, like his predecessor, Deval Patrick, was trying to get rid of it, and he had this kind of clever strategy to do it, where he sort of set up this uncomfortable decision for lawmakers, right? Like, we're going to eliminate the film tax credit and use that money to pay for expansion. The earned income tax credit. So, like, who are you picking? You know, hardworking families or Hollywood? But lawmakers managed to find a way around that, and they cut this corporate tax break instead, and managed to keep the film tax credit.
Yeah, Renee.
Well, I thought that was a curious part of the budget, and there's a couple of curious things in this budget. But one is this swap that they made between the earned income tax credit, you know, which is for the lowest income workers in the state. And this corporate tax credit, because the corporate tax credit has never actually been used. Am I right?
Yes.
So it's a little bit of, you know, swapping real money that they're going to need to be paying to the low-income applicants to the earned income tax credit, swapping that real money for sort of theoretical money that's really just on paper. I mean, I understand that the budget is always just on paper, but I just am curious to see how that works out.
Interesting. Well, we'll see how that goes on with every passing week as the reality of the new budget starts setting in. But as we heard a little earlier from Speaker DeLeo, he said the budget also includes funding for substance abuse, for particularly to combat the opioid addiction crisis. And that happened as at the same time this week, the CDC released a new report that found that heroin use has soared nationally, particularly among women and non-Hispanic whites. And of course, here in Massachusetts, heroin claimed more than 1,000 lives in the Bay State last year. We have some tape from Michael Botticelli. He's the White House Director of National Drug Control Policy, and he spoke about addiction this week and the need to destigmatize addiction to increase access to care.
Only about 18% of people who need treatment in the United States get care and access to this disorder. And one of the biggest factors that keep people from seeking care is stigma. They're ashamed to tell their employer, they're ashamed to tell their friends, and we know that stigma prevents and delays people from getting care.
Well, Renee, let me start with you. I mean, the CDC report really focusing on the rise of addiction amongst women and non-Hispanic whites. In a way, that's not really news in Massachusetts because we've been dealing with this so long. But I was wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, I think nationally, the sort of good news in this report is that it will help get it out of the shadows. And, you know, I've heard medical professionals draw parallels to the AIDS crisis, in which once people started realizing that their neighbors and their coworkers and, you know, ordinary so-called people were suffering from this disease, it got attention and people were able to get care. And, you know, we can only hope that, you know, maybe it's cynical to say that once, you know, white people and women and middle class people become the face of this disease, it'll start getting the attention that it deserves. But we can only hope that that'll be the case.
Yeah. Callum, your thoughts?
Well, I think Renee's exactly right. I think that what the CDC report did was it kind of quantified a trend that we've sort of observed a little bit. I mean, you heard it just in the way you set it up, Meghna, right? We're seeing an attitude change as we're talking about this as a crisis, right, instead of a war that needs to be waged. You know, that's different language. That's a bit of a turnaround from the way that we've talked about serious drug use in the past. You know, and the report, like I said, it sort of indicates why that might be. You know, the biggest user group it found, you know, still fits sort of the old stereotype, you know, overwhelmingly male, uninsured, people on the dole, people making less than $20,000. You know, in other words, people who are easy to otherize, right?
Right.
Mm. But the report shows, as you said, increasing use among women, people who are relatively affluent, people who have insurance, white people. In other words, those are people you know, people like you. And what it does is it encourages us to maybe take it a little bit more seriously, as sad as that might be, and to treat it more like an illness as opposed to a crime.
Right. And in fact, speaking of the word crime, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we spoke to the Gloucester police chief, Leonard Campanello, who's really taken the novel approach of telling addicts that that if they come to the police department, they're not going to get arrested. In fact, that the police in Gloucester are actually going to try and find ways to assist those addicts. And he implemented this new system on June 1st. And about 36 people have taken him up on that offer. I mean, Renee, is this one of those things that sounds like the innovative, non-stigmatizing approaches that we really have to embrace even more passionately?
Yeah, I think it's part of what they call the harm reduction approach to drug use of all kinds. And, you know, the first focus has to be on reducing harm, reducing people hurting themselves with drugs and seeing it as a disease and not so much as a crime. And I think that this is, I favor this, and I think that it's a good sign.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to another big story that actually kicked off the week, and that is the trove of released documents from the ACLU of Massachusetts about the use of SWAT teams, armored vehicles, and military-style assault weapons by some local police forces. We talked to Cade Crockford, who's director of the Technology for Liberty Project with the Massachusetts ACLU, and she had reviewed some 900 pages of documents from NEMLEC, that's the Northeastern Massachusetts Law Enforcement Council. And Crockford told us that what she found was about 40% of the deployments of SWAT teams under NEMLEC control in Massachusetts were actually used to do things such as serve search or arrest warrants.
That is a completely different thing from what we are told the purpose of SWAT teams is, which is to, again, respond to extremely violent scenarios, right? The Watertown manhunt. 43% of these deployments are a far cry from that. They are routine law enforcement operations to serve warrants. And 63% of those warrant operations are related to drugs.
Well, we also spoke with John Fisher, who's the police chief for the town of Carlisle. He's also president of the NEMLEC executive board. And he actually defended the need for these type of SWAT team deployments.
I do think they're important. I do think it's an important resource for the cities and towns to have, because these are folks that train and they can keep the whole situation safer. That conducting business this way is best for the police officers involved, the suspects involved, and the citizen.
So, Callum, let's start with you. I mean, two really different views on you know, the use and effectiveness of SWAT teams at the local police department level. What do you take away from this?
Well, I think that both of those voices are almost could be inside the head of a single person, because you're sort of torn as a resident, I think, in how you feel about this. You know, on the one hand, many of those police operations do seem very routine, but you know, the police that I've talked to about this issue will say, you know, you're concerned about going into maybe it is just a search warrant related to a drug bust, but you believe that the suspects may be armed, and you feel much safer going in, say, in an armored vehicle, which, by the way, many of those armored vehicles that we've seen on TV in some of the most dramatic, you know, scenes of police militarization in Ferguson and Baltimore. A lot of those trucks, by the way, are made by a Massachusetts company, Lenco Armored Vehicles of Pittsfield. I've been out. I've toured the plant, talked to the president, Len Light. You know, and he's very genuine about wanting to protect police. But at the same time, you know, you watch the promotional marketing videos for that product, and it's, you know, it's the AC/DC music blaring. And, you know, it looks like a trailer for an action movie. So you got both things going on. Like, it's this, you know, pump you up, like, renegade type of attitude. But at the same time, he's saying, you know, we're about saving lives and making sure that officer gets home to his or her family at the end of the day.
But, I mean, Renee, I think one of the things to me that's at the heart of the matter is this a, you know, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail problem. Or in this case, when you have a wrecking ball, everything looks like a nail. Because, you know, is it an appropriate use? Is it an appropriate use of this kind of equipment?
Yeah, and, you know, it depends entirely on the use. I mean, this, you know, we have concerns about the militarization of local police. I think the real problem is that after September 11, Homeland Security and the federal government made available all kinds of money to local police stations, but they weren't able to use this money for personnel. They had to use it for one-time only expenses, which were hard equipment expenses. And so everybody bulked up with all of this, you know, these tanks and everything, you know, and I just, I actually looked into some of those documents myself, and it did seem that some of them were overreactions. There were, you know, there was a big SWAT operation at the Waltham High School graduation in 2013 because somebody had called in a threat, you know, 11 SWAT police, 15 regular police for 7 hours at the Waltham High School graduation. So, yes, I understand we were all, you know, on edge because of the marathon bombings that spring, but you know, you just have to wonder who is looking over the use of this and how badly it can go wrong.
Right. You know, it's funny you mentioned the marathon bombing, because we also talked to Ed DeVoe, Watertown chief of police, who's retiring after more than 30 years on the force. And he told my co-host Anthony in their conversation that, you know, on the day of the manhunt or afterwards, lots of people in Watertown told him that they were glad to see, you know, through their windows, those Bearcats rolling down the street. So there's, you know, one circumstance in which it seemed to be an appropriate use. But, you know, Callum, I mean, what's your thought on the example for that Renee brought up? Like, you know, if we have Bearcats available, should they be being deployed to high school graduations?
Yeah, well, that's why one of the big numbers I was looking for, and frankly, I was a little surprised that it was as low as it ended up being, was just how often are these SWAT teams deployed on these raids? And we got it wasn't a huge sample size, but we got like a 2-year sample from mid-2012 to mid-2014, and the total was 79 times. And that's not for the whole state, right? That's just for NEMLEC, which I think has like 60 or 61 police agencies
Yeah, 61.
As members. But so, in other words, this isn't something that's being used every single day, which I think is one of the greatest fears that you have. As you said, you know, if you have the hammer, does everything look like a nail? So once you have these cool new toys, are you looking for every opportunity to use them? That number, you know, 79 by 61 agencies over the course of 2 years suggests that there is at least some level of restraint being employed here.
Mm. Well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs, and those are the stories of the week that maybe didn't make it to the top of the newscast, as we might say in the radio biz. So, Renee, let's start with yours.
Well, public art in Boston has a reputation for being rather bland and predictable. You know, it's all those...
Oh, you're being so cruel, all
those,
so harsh.
You know, all those bronze...
So true.
All those, you know, I think of those bronze statues of men on horseback. You know, that is the public art of Boston. So for a bracing antidote to that, I would suggest people go see the giant inflatable rabbits that are on the lawn on D. This is a new public space that's next to the Boston Convention Center on D Street. They are fabulous, you know, and they're created by an Australian artist named Amanda Perrer, who built these huge and white and inflatable rabbits. They really make you feel like Alice. You feel very, very small. And these sculptures, though, are only on display for this weekend only. And so that's also an interesting example of the phenomenon in Boston, which is that our best public art tends to be temporary.
Right, right. I love the idea. I mean, why not have great art be fun as well for the public?
Feed your head.
Feed your head. Yeah. Callum, what's your hubbub today?
Well, Magna, you know me. You know where I'm going. I'm going to the world of sports.
Uh-huh.
And almost completely overshadowed by Sunday's World Cup win by the U.S. women's soccer team was another World Cup victory on the same day, and that came from the American softball team, which also beat Japan in the World Cup final for that sport. Now, you might say, oh, ho-hum, it's softball, and we always win at softball, right? It's America. But the U.S. and Japan had actually split the previous two World Cups, so this was kind of like a tiebreaker of sorts heading into next year, which of course is an Olympic year. But wait, softball, just like baseball, isn't in the Olympics anymore. People may have forgotten that. So I'm afraid this World Cup was about as big as it gets, and we basically missed it.
And we totally missed it, in fact. Well done, U.S. World Cup champion softball team. Hooray. And good thing you have a fan in Callum Borchers to educate us of your victory. And sorry about Japan. Wow, that's two losses in one day. My hubbub has to do with mathematics and the Museum of Science, because of course, as we may have heard, there was a young high school student from Virginia, I believe, who was at the Museum of Science recently in the Mathematica exhibit, and he was looking, which by the way was put together by Charles and Ray Eames, so really great, beautiful looking exhibit to begin with, and they had a portion of the exhibit that talks about the golden ratio, obviously very important for designers, architects, artists, everybody. And the young man found an error in the mathematical equation about what he says was the, let's see, the short side divided by the long side, and the golden ratio equals the square root of 5 minus 1 divided by 2. He tells the museum. The museum says, oh, no, you're right. It's incorrect. But no, then they turn around later and find out it's not incorrect, in fact, the equation that the young man wanted them to use was simply the reciprocal of the golden mean. So,
thank you for clearing that up.
I know. So
I knew that.
Of course. So did I, right? But anyway, I love the fact that mathematics and design and art all come together, and we all learn something. This is the theme today, Renee, learning something on Radio Boston. Well, Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe, always great to have you. Thanks so
Terrific.
Much.
Thank you.
And Callum Borchers, business writer for the Globe, always great to have you as well.
Always fun. Have a great weekend.
You too, everybody. Stay with us. There's more of the show in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.